tonight on Arena. Kerry Washington and Tyler Perry on their new movie, The 6888. And up for review are Queer, Craven the Hunter and the documentary Chasing the Light. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Tonight's film reviews Daniel Craig as a kind of William Burroughs in Love, Buddhism and Betrayal in West Cork, and the origin story of a superhero. In Queer, Daniel Craig plays William Lee, an American expat in post-war Mexico City who falls for Eugene, or Jean, Allerton, another young expat played by Drew Starkey who has just arrived in the city. Then we're off to West Cork on the documentary Chasing the Light about the Jogsen Bera, the Tibetan Buddhist centre there. And finally, Aaron Taylor-Johnson and Russell Crowe in the comic book adaptation Craven the Hunter. Serena Bellissimo and Donald Clark have been to the pictures for us. They're with me in studio this evening. And we'll start with Queer, adapted from William Burroughs' autobiographical novel of the same name, where it's 1950. Daniel Craig is William Lee, living in Mexico City, yet to publish any of his books, like Naked Lunch, that would make his names make him his name. And that is when he meets Jean Allerton. Serena, this is a film that director Luca Guadagnino has waited a long time to make.
Yeah.
So clearly it's a real passion project.
It is. He said he first read it when he was 17 and this book really struck a chord with him. And then at 20, he was like, I want to turn this into something. And now, all these years later, he's finally made it. And I have to say, I was saying to Donald outside, when I go to a film, I don't like to know too much about it. I like to go in and discover it. I think I did a disservice to this film by not...
In this case, you felt you needed to have a bit of the background.
Yeah, I don't know who William Burroughs is. So I walked in and I suppose you don't even need to know who he is or his story, but you just need to know a little bit about what this was about, because I was watching it going, I'm not understanding what story they're trying to tell.
Right. Well, this is interesting because I always think there is, if you should be able to go to anything and know nothing and at least
be able
to follow it, even if you don't fully know the background to it. William Burroughs, this is a colourful life, to say the very least.
It is. I was just talking to Serena Bud outside and I was doing my William Burroughs impersonation. I remember it from 19 Laurie Anderson Records. He turned up at that stage, was really kind of, he was one of those sort of characters who was the supreme author as imagined personality. By that stage anyway, that people, he dressed like a character he had created. Mm. I mean, up until the 70s and 80s, he was still wearing the conservative suit and the Macintosh and Trilby hat and really still spending his money from the Burroughs computer empire, which had supported him all through these wandering years. I mean, I saw it in Venice, actually, again, walking in without any knowledge of what the film was going to be like, but it sort of felt walking in as if it should be irresistible. Guadagnino was yet to make a dull film, I think. I mean, he's made some I'm not hugely keen on, but I mean, even the least of his films are interesting. And he cast Daniel Craig, who's a gritty, interesting actor, as William S. Burroughs. It's this early novel, which none of us had read until the 80s, until it was dragged up, about finding himself and his sexuality in Mexico City. There's also something always attractive about Bohemia, I think. It's a way of life that we feel that we would like to live, but probably wouldn't have the courage to live if we were there in the right... the right time in the right place, or wrong time in the right place. But I find it all enormously boring, which is a great surprise. I mean, huge sections of the opening hour are dull men smoking cigarettes and drinking beer in Mexico City bars and not saying anything very interesting.
Mexico City, 1950. Would have thought Mexico City at any time. Something colourful, certainly, to be
buzz
had there.
It doesn't buzz at all.
I think Donald's right. There's no buzz about it, but visually it is stunning. Mm. And I spent the first hour going, is that Jason Schwartzman? Jason Schwartzman looks completely different.
And what's he playing?
He plays one of the friends
of one of the people smoking cigarettes and drinking beer in bars.
One of the other fellas is chatting.
But the problem is with this film as well, it's a film of two halves. So you're watching the first film and, it's all about Lee trying to, deal with his addictions, deal with his fears as well, connection, loneliness, finally meets Jean. And it's like, okay, so this story's going somewhere. And then we end up in a jungle and Leslie Manville turns up and it's this drug-induced final
well, that
hour.
Was this film was originally supposed to be longer. I mean, there is out there somewhere a 3-hour cut of it, which they threatened us with at Venice before backing down and giving us the more easily digestible cut that we have here today. And I do feel watching the second half of the film, where, as Serena says, it goes very surreal and you get a bit of a sense of David Cronenberg's Naked Lunch about it, some of the hallucinatory sequences, that those felt so bolted on that I felt that I'm completely wrong on this, but I felt that a large portion of the bits that had gone missing in the original cut must have been more of that hallucinatory stuff. Because that felt like a whole different film that had been bolted on at the later stages of the cut that we have.
Let's listen to a clip now. They do talk about some things at some point.
They talk a lot.
They talk about food. And who knew that Baked Alaska could cause such a controversial conversation as this? William Lee, played by Daniel Craig, and he and Drew Starkey, who plays Gene Allerton, are looking at a menu in a bar. Baked Alaska is on the menu.
Oh, they list Baked Alaska. Ever eat it?
No.
Real good. It's hot on the outside and cold inside.
That's why they call it Baked Alaska, I imagine.
You know, I got an idea for a new dish. You take a live pig and you throw it into a very hot oven. So the pig is roasted outside. When you cut into it, it's still alive and twitching inside. Or, if we run a dramatic joint, a screaming pig covered with burning brandy runs out of the kitchen. And dies right by the chair. You just reach down, you pull off the crispy, crackly ears, and you eat them with your cocktail.
That's Daniel Craig as William Lee and Drew Starkey as Eugene Allerton or Gene Allerton in Queer. I have to say, you know, they sound like the two characters are having a great time, but I don't know that I'm being entertained listening to them, Serena.
No, you're not. Do you know what entertained me the most, actually? And I wish I'd written down what I was hearing as I was hearing it. The soundtrack.
Oh, well, yeah. I quite like they've got not contemporary soundtrack, but they've got
it's
music
not in the
that's
50s.
Not from that era.
Yeah.
So you've got Nirvana at the beginning, and you've got a bit of New Order going through it, which I liked, and I've never a problem with that technique.
Yeah,
of like
so and that soundtrack worked for you, Serena. It was the best bit of it.
Yeah, and as Donald said, it never actually felt like it didn't deserve to be there. You're not there going, but Nirvana weren't around in the 50s. It suited. He was more about what music would suit that mood. But,
I think because we haven't talked about the sexuality as well.
I was going to ask you, what about there's much, there's a lot to talk about the sex scenes. I mean, but is it worth all the fuss?
No. I mean, I was surprised. I emerged. I mean, it's one of the interesting things when you go and see a premiere of a film for them to talk about it, you're going to form all these ideas in your head and then walk out and discover everyone's got different ideas about it, which is fun and exciting. Yeah. But I mean, I was then surprised to read all these reviews which talked about the daring and boundary pushing sex scenes, which they're reasonably explicit. I mean, I don't care one way or the other, but I mean, I certainly wasn't, you know, rocked back in my seat by the passion and explicitness of the sex scenes. They felt a bit coy, if anything, to me. I felt that they lacked kind of like, you know, the vim and the energy you'd expect from a sex scene that really gets you.
And what is there
anything? See, I thought it was bold because we don't see that on screen very often, right? So that's where I just go, representation matters. You know, they didn't shy away from showing us two naked bodies on the screen and actually having sex like you would see if it was a heterosexual couple. So I think that's great, but it was funny. I was talking to one of my mates before I came in and I said to him, are you going to go see Queer? And he said, no, my husband and I don't want to go anywhere near this because they feel for them it's semi-autobiographical.
William Burroughs, yeah.
But he's like, I can't see another story that I relate to, but is all about tragedy. I want to see a story that celebrates.
Okay. Well, that's and I think it's interesting from someone who hasn't seen the film in that case, it's actually a very fair point. It is one of those old-fashioned gay stories where essentially people are coping with living outside society and being doomed to misery. I mean, those terrible, terrible stories that were thrown at us for decades and decades. There's a bit of that going on.
He doesn't want to say that anymore.
Yeah, they're not crazy to decide that's how they might see.
All right. It sounds like a bit of a mixed bag, stars from you, Donald.
Two. I didn't care for it. I was very disappointed.
Didn't care for it. Very disappointed.
I'll give this 2.5.
2.5.
Yeah.
You cared for it a teeny bit.
It's okay. Like, it is visually stunning. I'll give you that.
Well, if that's visually stunning. So two and 2.5 respectively there for Queer. Visually stunning, not as visually stunning as West Cork, I would say. I would have to say, because that's where we're going to next. And a tale that begins in 1973 with Peter Cornish, an Englishman, but born of Irish stock, buying a piece of land there and founding a spiritual retreat. We listen to a little bit of Peter Cornish just at the very top of the music, top of the film rather, because he kind of sets out why he went there in the first place.
Everybody's looking for a place within themselves, really, but you need to find it outside first, probably. A place of quiet and peace as the world steams up. A place to escape from society and from the chaos of the world.
And even that's Peter Cornish in the opening scenes there of Chasing the Light. And even as you hear that and the speed at which Peter Cornish delivers his lines to camera, when I say delivery, it's a documentary, so he's speaking directly to camera. Nobody is in a hurry here. And if they're in a hurry to do anything, it's in a hurry to slow down.
It is. And it's so funny. So like I was watching this and I'm always in a rush trying to do stuff. I'm just going, wow, for the first 60 minutes, I actually felt myself calming down.
Because even that title, Chasing the Light.
Yeah, and I almost felt like, and this doesn't mean it was boring, but I just found in that first, it goes for, I think, an hour and a half, and in that first 60 minutes, I just found myself going, oh, is this what meditation feels like? Like, I'm slowing down. And I was amazed at Peter and Harriet that they decided everything was hand-built and then they, this isn't a spoiler, but, you know, they gave this place up to the community and built a temple for everybody to sort of enjoy the vision that they had in their lives. Yeah. But you're sitting there after the first 60 minutes going, okay, I'm ready for this to be over now and I really hope it doesn't go sour, and bang on the 60-minute mark.
We talk about films of two halves. This is a film of, I suppose, two-thirds and a third, because it kind of 60 minutes, it's about an hour in when the bomb is dropped that we're not just going to deal with the people who come to this retreat and who are searching for some spirituality.
It's an odd one because there is no hint this is going to come, that it transpires that one of the gurus, one of the senior figures,
who comes in later on into the community.
In the wider worldwide community of this particular Buddhist sect, the right word, was implicated in sexual scandal, as unfortunately happens far too often these days. And then the latter half of the film, well, portions of the latter half of the film is them being pretty honest about it. There's no attempt to kind of rationalise it or no attempt to explain it away. But what they're mainly talking about, I think, is a kind of personal spiritual grief that somebody in whom they'd invested a lot of trust had turned out to be someone who didn't deserve that trust.
Yeah, and it's important to point out here that the person in question was never found guilty of any of these crimes. They're purely their allegations, but it did. He retired from any kind of, and had written worldwide books, huge success as Sogyal Rinpoche, if I'm saying his name correctly there. And it is peculiar in the way the film, in the way it deals with that, because I was expecting when this question about sexual abuse and sexual activity came into it, I thought it was going to go somewhere else, but I wasn't much wiser at the end of the film than I was at the beginning, apart from having slowed down to watch it.
Yeah, no, I think they just wanted to go, here is the story. I think the focus wasn't Sogyan, if I'm saying it right. It wasn't him. It was more about the temple and what this temple is about, chasing the light. But they had to tell that part of the story. But they couldn't tell the whole story without mentioning that. So I think what they did was they went, we're going to acknowledge that this happened, but please don't let one man's actions mar the hope that we have for this building.
Yeah, and when we say we're going to acknowledge that this happened, I just want to be clear again, that this scandal arose, what happened.
Yeah.
And it is interesting in that regard. It manages to tell this story. It manages to tell many people, different people within the community who have different attitudes and different versions of that story, Donald.
Well, it does. And I think, but as we've already explained, it feels like they had no alternative but to include that.
Well, they're
that
so truthful
the
that they weren't going to cover it up.
And that's why it's there. The film is not about that. The film is about this sort of small miracle about, you know, establishing something very unlikely in a remote part of the world, and more unlikely in the middle of the 70s and in the 80s, I think, when the temple eventually arrived, than it would be now. I mean, I think there's an accidental, this is not mentioned, but there's an accidental wider story here, which is being told in part about the 70s in Ireland and that community of people, that movement of people from Europe, from Britain, from Germany, a lot of Germans in the post-hippie era, not all of them hippies, but in that kind of adjacent hippie communities who came here and set up various different organisations or just private homes throughout rural Ireland. And some of them went home, but many of them stayed. And I think there's an interesting tribute to that, you know, that set of people who also at a time in this country that was not particularly open to other attitudes, not up onto other, and immigration was tiny at that stage, brought a bit of colour and I think a bit of eclecticism to the country in those years.
And again, what you got from the community in that period was how all embracing they were. They wanted to embrace the entire community around them and wanted to be part of that community, not considered separate from it.
Exactly. I did find, as someone who didn't grow up here, I do find these films where I look back and go, wow. Like, it's only, I don't know, to young people, 50 years sounds like a long time ago, right? But it really is only 50 years ago. And Ireland was such a very different country to,
we're talking about the 1970s. We're not talking about the
1970s. Yeah. It remained that way for another 20 years, but, you could argue.
And that, as an outsider, that to me was a shocking part of this as well, going, well, Australia was a very different place.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that that was seen so different and so revolutionary in the 70s.
Yoga was considered
very exotic. It was like kung fu. It was
and perhaps sinfully.
Yes. I mean, I would say that I was not, I mean, a large part of this film is people talking in a way that feels a little bit like an advertisement for Buddhism, talking about what it does for them. I didn't connect with that. I mean, I didn't feel that there was any, I mean, there's no reason they should make an attempt to reach out to people like myself who don't.
They weren't proselytizing, I don't think, were they?
No. But nonetheless, for someone like myself who, as I always say rather facetiously, I don't really believe in organized religion, but I'm not a spiritual person either. but I did any attempt to reach out to people like ourselves who don't really worry about that spiritual side of the personality. So that was kind of all Greek to me, I have to say, to a certain extent. But I thought it was beautifully made, and I did not in any way interfere with my admiration for what they'd managed to set up in the most unlikely circumstances.
Yeah, it is a good story.
And you were quite right, Sean, as well, to point out that, you know, it's getting a limited theatrical release, and it is actually worth going seeing in the cinema because of those wonderful vistas of the Atlantic coast.
You'll be moving down tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's absolutely stunning. So stars from you on this one, Donald?
3.5.
What are you saying,
Serene?
I'd give
it a 3.
A solid 3 for you, Chasing the Light, our second film this evening. Let's move on then to Craven the Hunter. You've seen this one, Donald.
Yeah.
A much-delayed Sony film. The origin story of the superhero played by Aaron Taylor-Johnson. Russell Crowe is his father, a Russian oligarch.
Yeah.
Is it a case of like father, like son? What is actually happening in Craven the Hunter?
Well, you know what? So many American films are about fathers. I don't know what it is with that country and their men and their fathers. That there's so many of those films are about people sorting out their relationship with the generation that came before. I mean, look, I mean, we are, I think, finally at the end of the car boot sale that Sony Films set up to dispose of the bits of furniture that were left over when Spider-Man ran off to Disney.
I can hear you loved it.
Look, I'm not a lawyer, as you know, but they seem to have ended up, they've kept control, basically, of the villains and related characters, Morbius, Venom, Madam Web, all of whom went on to generate terrible, terrible films, some of which made money, it should be said. The Venom films didn't do too badly. But I mean, the previous ones, including Madam Web, which was included on many lists of worst films of 2024, they were kind of bad in an entertaining way.
Yeah.
I mean, they were awful, but they were, I mean, I would not discourage anybody from watching Madame Web on whatever streaming service it's currently on. It's awful, but it's kind of funny and it's awful.
It's good, it's awful.
This so is really dull.
Well, I mean, who is Craven the Hunter?
This is dull as queer.
Craven with a K, we should point out here.
Well, I remember him being the villain in Spider-Man comics. I was a big Marvel fan as a kid. Mm. One of the ones you were a bit disappointed to see when you really wanted to see the Green Goblin or Kingpin in one of those. I mean, not least because you couldn't quite understand what he did.
Right.
I mean, he's a hunter, and he wears this lion's mane of a jerkin that he doesn't actually wear until the very last shot. Is that a spoiler? Tell me what people are wearing in the last shot of the film. Anyway, doesn't wear that in the last shot of the film, and he sort of hunted Spider-Man, and you couldn't really figure out what his thing was.
Okay, well, let's listen to a clip which will make everything totally clear to you. This is Aaron Taylor Johnson as Craven. He's on a tour of vengeance for some reason.
He basically becomes this kind of Avenger figure, not Avenger with a capital A, but a small A, sorting out various problems throughout the world. So he's actually not really a villain for the first.
All right, so he's paying
film.
Back for payback things done to other people. Yeah. All right. He's another arch enemy involved here. Yuri Kolnikov. I kid you not. That is the name.
Yuri Kolnikov.
I'm saying again, Yuri Kolnikov meets his fate.
Mr. Taglin, I apologise. This guy came out of nowhere. But I took care of it. He won't be bothering us anymore.
In a moment, you won't be bothered by much of anything.
How did you? Where's Mr. Taglin?
Oh, you're standing in him.
There we go. That's poor old Yuri Kolnikov meeting his end as he stands. I can't remember the name of the character he was standing in. So that is Aaron Taylor Johnson as Craven. I get it that you didn't like this film. Aaron Taylor Johnson done any? Is this going to get him any closer to James Bond?
No. I mean, God knows what's going on with that project. I mean, I don't know what Barbara Broccoli and Eon are up to, but I mean, they've had, 2.5 years to come up with the James Bond? And it looked a lot like Aaron Taylor Johnson was.
Creating some buzz around it, perhaps?
Yeah, but only after a certain point, people start to get irritated by the lack of buzz that's actually building up. I mean, he looked genuinely likely. No, he won't do him any harm, to be fair.
Yeah.
I mean, no one's going to hold this against him. It's not really his fault. He's perfectly fine in it. But there is, I felt, a genuine sense of kind of poignancy at the end of all this, where you have them setting up these characters, and particularly Craven himself, who ends up in the last scene sitting in his chair, looking at the mirror and pulling on the, I won't say famous, but, you know, the vaguely famous lion's mane coat and staring in the mirror. I'm like, I'm never going to see you again, mate. I mean, you know, it's great you set this character up and we're off, but, like, you know, that's the end of it.
All right. I'm afraid to ask you for stars on this one.
It's a one. It's a onesir.
It's a onesir. Okay. Well, I suppose it could have been worse than a onesir. Chasing the Light and Queer, the three films that we've been speaking about there. Just before we let you go, Donald, the Critics' Choice Awards, the American Critics' Choice Awards nominations today. Notable here. Is this really a kind of a, if you want to know what's going to happen in the Oscars, here's
not
a fairly...
Not really. I mean, they're also ran nothing burger of awards that come out in this period of time. The Golden Globes, which are themselves, like, you know, a bit erratic. I mean, they're much more... Yeah.
I was getting excited because of the Best Foreign Language Film nominations.
Well, it's interesting.
Including
Camp did not get into the Golden Globes, but I would say again, and Colin Kuehn didn't get into the Golden Globes and I would absolutely count on Kneecap getting a long list, and a short list, on the 17th of this month, and then 50-50 probably on the nomination, but a good chance still. It didn't get in here. Alicia Weir, delighted to see.
But it did. Kneecap gets into Best Foreign
I was back with the Golden Globes still in my head. Yes, it gets in here in the Critics' Choice, which is a good sign. And bad sign again. It looks like Saoirse Ronan's over? She's not over in any
way. For this award season,
I mean, looked like she could well get two nominations in the Oscars.
Well, the Outrun in particular, I think people were quite excited about. The Outrun
got great reviews. People liked it, but it was a small film that people didn't go and see. I mean, I think Blitz. Steve McQueen's Blitz was, I think, I mean, for me, it was one of the most anticipated films of the year. I was really looking forward to it, and just it went down with a splat. I think she's suffering because the films, in different ways, didn't score with voters.
But Alicia Weir, you are excited about.
Great to see her. She's in for best young actor in the Critics' Choice, yes.
And that's in the film Abigail.
It's the horror film.
So in with a big chance there, would you think,
I don't know how the Critics' Choice will go on that. I mean, but obviously there isn't a corresponding Oscar race, so I'm afraid that she won't be. But I suppose so. I mean, those races are kind of erratic. Those extra ones, the ones that don't score on the headlines. So there's every chance, I would suppose.
All right. Thanks for that, Donald, and thank you also to Serena Bellissimo earlier for her opinions on our three films. The 6888 was the only black female battalion of the US Army to be stationed overseas during the Second World War, and their task while in Europe was a unique one: to sort the millions, 17 million in fact, of letters to and from the front that the meagre postal service of the era was unable to cope with. The story of this remarkable battalion and the work they did has been dramatised in a new film from writer and director Tyler Perry. It stars Kerry Washington as Major Charity Adams, who led these women and held her own in a deeply racist and deeply sexist institution. Perry and Washington first worked together on Perry's For Coloured Girls in 2010 and have since maintained a creative friendship. With the 6888, their shared passion for highlighting overlooked chapters of history comes full circle as they chronicle the extraordinary story of the 6888th Central Postal Directory Battalion. Earlier today, I spoke to Tyler Perry and Kerry Washington. Before we hear that conversation, let's hear a clip from the film where Major Adams is introducing herself to the new recruits.
I am Captain Charity Adams, and I will be your commanding officer. What that means is when I say do it, you get it done. There are rules for the Army, and they must be abided, and they are strict. I expect you to follow them to the letter. No exceptions, none will be tolerated. We start training at 6:30. You have to be here at Reveille. If you are on time, you are late, so you must be early. Each of you has a locker and a trunk. Everything you own must fit inside those two items. You will not wear complicated makeup. You have to shave your legs. You must use deodorant, and you must shower at least once a day. And if you do not know how to use a tampon, we will teach you. You have to stand up straight. Posture is important. We walk with our head up, our back straight, and our butt in. That is how we walk. Your uniform must be perfect. Lieutenant Campbell will teach you how to make them perfect. These uniforms were designed for the pencil figure of a white woman, not the curves of a Negro. But I am sure that more than a few of us know how to make use of a needle and thread, and so we will make them perfect. They must be perfect. No exceptions. You are not only in the Army, you are women, and you are Negroes. And because you are Negroes and women, you do not have the luxury to be as good as the white soldiers. You have the burden to be better.
Kerry Washington, who plays the character of Charity Adams, and in the film, the 6888, and Tyler Perry, who directs the movie. Great to have you with us here on Arena this evening. That speech, Kerry, really gives us a sense of the nature of this woman and what she had to fight in terms of misogyny and in terms of racism, straightforward racism, to rise to the top of the American Army as she did.
Yeah, she was so extraordinary. And, you know, she was only 26 years old. I keep joking, you know, when I was 26, I didn't have command of myself, never mind 855 other women. But she was so brave and so brilliant and really fearless, you know, to go into this situation and demand a mission and then meet that mission. She's really so inspiring. This entire regiment of women, all 855 of them, are such examples of what's possible despite how people might doubt you or you might doubt yourself. And so it's such a beautiful opportunity for us to be able to tell this story.
In fact, I was thinking, Tyler, there probably are 855 films to be made about this regiment. I'm sure there are that many stories within it. But the attempt here, there was a real attempt to sideline this particular battalion of the Women's Army Corps by getting them involved in what was considered a menial task, albeit 17 million letters and packages that hadn't been delivered and that nobody had managed to solve that problem up to that. The power of the letter is essential to the story here.
Yes, it really is. And I think that in our modern times, these modern days, we may not be able to fully appreciate that what a letter represented. So for me, the letter had to be a character in the film. Mm-hmm. It had to be clear to the audience how important a letter was, because, you know, when Carrie and I first talked about it, she goes, how do you do a movie about the mail? Mm-hmm. So it was really important that we let the audience know, especially, you know, from this day and age, how important a letter was. I mean, these soldiers were not hearing from home, and home was not hearing from the soldiers. They didn't know if they were alive or what was going on. And you can imagine what that would do with one's morale.
Yeah. And in fact, I play another clip of Kerry here as Charity Adams, just explaining to the women of the battalion exactly the power of these and the importance of these letters and packages.
This mail has been sitting here for over 10 months. And not just in this airplane hangar, in all of them. Every single hangar is full of mail. The soldiers who are fighting this war have not heard from their loved ones. And their loved ones have not heard from them. Now, the War Department is getting thousands of complaints, and the morale of our soldiers is at an all-time low. And if our soldiers have low morale, they have no fight. Ladies, we have been ordered to provide hope and communication and care packages to our exhausted soldiers on the front lines and to let their families back home know if they are safe or if they have died in battle.
There you are again, Kerry Washington as Charity Adams. This idea of hope being given to not only the soldiers on the front, but to people at home. It's a hugely emotional aspect of the film.
Yeah, I think it's really about connection and community and remembering what we're fighting for. I think that is something that the soldiers really needed. And the fact that these women could provide that hope to help end the war was just, it's a tremendous part of history that it's so important to be told.
It's funny that you mentioned connection and community there, because there's one of the, I find the watching of the film, I have to say, on many occasions, very, very emotional, very, very moving. But one particular scene, I wondered about how emotional it was to do. It's a big scene where the General Halt, played so brilliantly, really nastily, nastily said, but brilliantly by Dean Norris. He has belittled you in front of the entire battalion, or belittled Charity Adams in front of the entire battalion. He leaves the room. The women stand absolutely stock still to attention. They hold that stand to attention, and then they burst into applause. The emotion watching it was huge. What was the emotion like on set for that particular scene?
It was electric. Mm-hmm. It was really electric. I feel like we were I feel like the real women were with us in the room, and that we were, I felt like I was defending every background artist in the room, every member of the Real 6888, every woman anywhere who'd ever met sexism, every black person who'd met racism. It felt like this kind of ancestral communal anger that came up through me in that moment. And I was defending their humanity in the way that Charity Adams was. Because it's funny to think, you know, she really, in real life, she said that to a general. She said, over my dead body.
Yeah.
And she was court-martialed in real life. But as she says in the scene with the chaplain, she knew the laws of the army inside and out. So she won her case. She held her standing in the army. But she did break the rules of the army in that moment. And I think she did it out of love. She did it to say, we have been fighting so hard for you and you will not fight for us. And I love her courage in that moment.
Yeah, I must say you could feel that there was a real sense of all of those things you spoke about, and almost that you were fighting the battle for generations of people. There's also huge emotional health, Tyler, in the story of Lena Dericott. You had the real Lena Dericott as a consultant on the film.
Yes, and I think that had I not met her, I wouldn't have had my way into the film. At 99 years old, I wasn't sure how clear she would be in her memory, but she was as sharp as a tack in every memory that she had. And so much so that I went to the historian and asked, how factual is what she's telling me? And he was blown away by her recall. So to have her lead us in through her memory of Abram and what happened to him, and also to be able to finish the movie, get a cut, and rush it to her bedside for her to see before she passed at 100 years old. That was really, really a powerful moment.
Well, you know, why don't we finish up then by having, not Lena, but Ebony Obsidian, who plays the character of Lena.
She's amazing.
We'll finish with that. The moment where she's telling her family, I'm off to join the army.
But you were sleeping.
Probably couldn't, huh?
Mama, I made a decision.
Okay.
After I graduate, I'm going to join the army. I want to fight Hitler.
Look at me, baby. I know you are hurting about Abram. We all are. But that ain't no reason for you to go to no army. And from what I hear tell, ain't no Negro woman doing nothing in no army but cooking and cleaning for the white folks. Hell, you can stay right here and do that. You was going to that university.
With what money? I'm going to join the army. As soon as I graduate, that's what I'm gonna do.
Ebony Obsidian there as Lena Dericott telling the other members of her family, played by Don Biscoe and Badgerlyn Adams, that she wants to join the army. That from the film The 6888. And before that clip, we heard Kerry Washington and Tyler Perry speaking to us about that film. It's in selected cinemas now and it will be available on Netflix from Friday of next week, December 20th. Sorry about this. There are just 12 days left until Christmas, and for those of you trying to find a gift for the art lover in your life, we have invited Jessica Fahey into studio to guide us through some of the best art books that have been published in the last year. And Goga, particularly in your first two choices this evening, Jessica, we spoke to Sue Prido about her biography of Paul Gauguin, Wild Thing, A Life of Paul Gauguin, published by Faber. And I remember I asked her on the night, to what extent was she rehabilitating the character of Paul Gauguin in this novel, or in this book rather? What needed rehabilitation, and is that what she's doing? You're already grimacing slightly, Jess, I have to say.
Well, there's a lot, really, but I suppose the thing about someone like Gauguin is there's no denying how important his art is within, you know, the Western art tradition, in particular because he was breaking with the Western art tradition, and he was looking at ways of bringing in other cultures. Of course, immediately the problem with that is that's still a white European taking, you know, another culture and making it only seen through their perspective. But it gets worse than that, because when he went to Tahiti in the 1890s, and he went a couple of times, and then ends up dying in the South Pacific as well, he takes on, as he would sort of term it, young wives, but they were 13-year-old girls. So, I mean, the stories are, you know, beyond just whether he was a bit of a scoundrel and actually just how bad a person he was.
And how does she, I don't know whether she excuses the writer, but how does she contextualise that or explain that to us?
So she suggests that our judgment comes from our perspective today, and that we have to see these figures in their own context. The problem, I suppose, with that is that when she's praising him, she praises him by today's standards. And when she's, you know, letting him away with certain things, she then goes back to that same point. So I don't know if I agree with her all the way through on that. But I'm certainly not a fan of the other option, which would be the cancel culture that we're getting so used to.
So you would rather that we concentrated on the art rather than the... Although that's difficult, again, with Gauguin, because of the nature of the paintings that we get of these young teenage girls.
And actually, I wouldn't either. I would actually say we do need to talk about who he was and what he did, but while looking at the art, and not just sort of erase him entirely and say, we don't like him, so we're going to not have exhibitions of his work or anything like that anymore.
The other aspect of his, the scandalous side, if you want to put it that way. What did or didn't happen in and around Van Gogh?
Well, that's the thing. As I think, you know, in some ways, you can understand Gauguin in that situation. So basically, Gauguin had worked as a stockbroker and then decided quite late in life to become an artist. He had a family to support, which he doesn't end up supporting, but he ends up needing money. And one of the ways that he starts to get some attention from his art is Theo, Vincent's brother, purchases some of his art and then says, look, I'll pay you 100 francs a month to go down to south of France and paint with my brother down there. So Gauguin goes down with the idea of this is a paying job. Vincent thinks he's getting a sort of artistic companion and someone to explore new ideas with. And very quickly it becomes apparent that Gauguin's only there for the money, and that also Vincent might be a little bit of a difficult person to live in such close quarters with, and they disagree on art ideas as well. So I think the sort of explosion comes about because Gauguin is going to leave and Vincent desperately wants him to stay.
And again, I mean, Prideaux, to be fair, goes into the research is very in-depth here, and she lays out her arguments very clearly, but it's a long and it's a big read.
Yes.
You wouldn't do it justice to try to dismiss it in a couple of sentences. So that's one of the books about Gauguin, Wild Thing, A Life of Paul Gauguin, published by Faber. The second book is from Stephanie Abraham, The Case of the Disappearance. Hearing Gauguin, A Study of Authenticity and the Art Market. And this is kind of maybe about Gauguin is too strong a description here. It takes one specific artwork and works out into a big argument about, as the title suggests, authenticity and the art market.
Yeah, so one of the things, again, because it comes from Gauguin, that's interesting, is as famous as he is now, he wasn't that successful in his lifetime. So it was very easy for, say, him to sell off a work. It would go into some private collection and, you know, not really have enough essential provenance or things that prove who it's by. And then depending on who needs it to be by him or not by him, different arguments of art historians and dealers will come along and try... argue for authenticity or not. And this makes a big difference, of course, to the value of the work. And that's often why we get some slightly suspicious stories over the years about value. But there's a real art historical interest too, because it could change how we view an artist's oeuvre based on whether or not that's by that artist or not. So it's a fascinating way of doing it by taking that one painting, following it all the way through of the ups and downs of that sort of value or not value in relation to the art market.
Rather than, you know, having a scattergun approach to giving us loads of examples, and we get so many examples we don't know what the argument is. So this is very straightforward.
Absolutely.
In that respect. The Case of the Disappearing Gauguin, A Study of Authenticity and the Art Market, published by Roman and Littlefield, Littlefelt perhaps, and it is by Stephanie A. Brown. Let's move on to another book. This is Isabel Kahn, a book called Bonnard, published by Prestel, and obviously we are speaking speaking here about Pierre Bonnard. Mm-hmm.
So yes, of the same era pretty much as Gauguin, but younger. A great follower of his as well, as many were, because Gauguin again had that sort of, we're back to Gauguin again, he had that sort of personality where he was like a kind of godlike figure to some of these younger artists, and they all wanted, you know, to have his attention and his approval. But Bonnard is a really interesting artist in his own right. He was part of a group known as La Nabi, which roughly translates as the prophets from Hebrew. And what they meant by that was that they were the new avant-garde. They were going to show the way. They were going to show you what's to come in art. And his version of that is to take very quiet, small, domestic moments and paint them through his own recollection of them.
In fact, if we tweet one of them out right now, I think this probably speaks to what you're talking about there, Boy Eating Cherries from 1895, which is in our own National Gallery. You could see it over the Christmas period if you wanted.
Yeah, we have three by him, which is actually quite extraordinary. But this is the most representative, you know, of what we would expect from Bonnard. So in this particular one, it's a grandmother, which is actually Bonnard's mother, with his nephew Jean. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a portrait, because it's meant to be just a record.
A boy eating cherries.
Exactly, domestic scene. And in it, you can see that the little boy is wearing this Czech shirt, but it looks like it's been cut out, like a piece of Czech has been cut out and stuck onto the canvas. It hasn't, it's been painted on, but there's no shading, no modelling. So he's doing something quite different in that he remembers that what the child was wearing was that Czech, but he doesn't remember exactly how the light hit it. So when he's doing it in this sort of recollecting kind of way of painting, he gives it these sort of flat patterns, which makes it immediately seem non-naturalistic. So we start to realise it is something more than him just sitting and painting what's in front of him.
Yeah, but although I do like, which sounds so unromantic, remember that a picture, this is him speaking, before being a battle horse, a nude, an anecdote or whatnot, is essentially a flat surface covered with colours assembled in a certain order. Don't be spoiling it on me.
It wasn't him. That was actually Denis, his contemporary. But they were part of that same group.
Right.
But that is the revelation of modernism. Yeah. That is the massive change.
Briefly, he also was an influence on Toulouse-Lautrec and the Isle posters.
Yeah, absolutely. He designed a poster called French Champagne, which is fantastic, sort of bubbly confection. And Toulouse-Lautrec saw it and thought, that's great.
I'll do that.
And then he started to win the commissions over poor old Bonnard.
There you go. Be careful what you show to people.
Yeah.
All right. That's our second book. What did I say it was called? The Pierre Bonnard?
Bonnard.
It's just simply called Bonnard. Mm-hmm. All right. Let us move on then to Chasing Beauty, the life of Isabella Stewart Gardner. An art collector, essentially. Is that how we would describe her?
Yes, and a very determined one to do it for the public. So she was from a very wealthy family in America, and her father, in fact, made a lot of his money dealing in linen, which he got from Ireland, and then went into mining and other things. And he was of that kind of, you know, robber baron era of the Gilded Age, and made lots of money. And she inherits, you know, close to 2 million back then. And her early education had been in Europe, so she was aware of art collections and private collections, and also the value of art and beauty for the public. So she makes it her life's goal to collect and then to build this extraordinary palace in Boston that will then put on this exhibition of her work.
And it's a museum now, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. Mm-hmm. We have a tweet and image here of John Singer Sargent's portrait of Isabella Stewart Gardner. They became friends, introduced by Henry James. They were moving in the right circles, weren't they?
Absolutely. And you see that happen a lot, actually. Henry James seems to be a good person to know back then. He introduced lots of people. But they're similar in that they're kind of exiles almost in Europe, like, you know, not literally exiles, but of their own choice. And they're part of these interesting intellectual circles. But Sargent and Isabella Stewart Gardner become lifelong friends, and he paints her many times, and they actually had, you know, a lot of similar ideas about art, and she was the sort of right person as a patron for him as well, which was really important.
Natalie Dijkstra is the author here, I should have said that, and the book is called Chasing Beauty, The Life of Isabella Stewart Gardner, published by Mariner Books. And finally, I looked, even the title of this had me going, pardon? Hieronymus Bosch and the Other Renaissance. Mm. So what are we hearing about here, this new Renaissance?
Yeah, well, so it has long been kind of discussed, the Renaissance, in relation to the proper, if you like, being the Italian Renaissance, yeah, because it means rebirth, and it's the rebirth of the classical world, and the Italian style tends to reference classical texts or classical sculptures or architecture. Northern Renaissance has always been kind of viewed sort of as a little bit lesser or more Gothic or slower to take off. And that's a very unfair assessment. Also, the idea even of assessing them geographically, this book challenges that and says, well, actually, it's more about ideas. And the same idea might be in, you know, the Netherlands as might be in Venice.
And if we tweet now the triptych by Hieronymus Bosch, The Garden of Earthly Delights, what does that tell us about this other Renaissance that the authors here, Bernard Akema and Fernando Checas Cremades, are speaking about?
So it's in the Prado, this work. And yeah, one of the writers is previous director of the Prado. So we would know the work very well. And it has, again,
perhaps a little biased.
Yes, possibly. But it is an extraordinary painting. It's one of the most interesting in the world to go and see, because you just can't stop looking at it. There's so much to see. But it had often been viewed as lesser or older fashioned in some way to, say, his contemporary, which would be Leonardo da Vinci. So they're of the same era, Bosch and da Vinci. Mm. But when you actually look at it, there's elements of sophistication in that, as elements of very important literary resources, biblical resources, and it's not just something based on a kind of a bizarre medieval version of heaven and hell or the Garden of Eden. And actually, it's much more of an intellectual thing, which would be what we consider the Italian Renaissance to be.
Worth looking at this one, and I hope lots of big, there was a really big, you remember that huge Hieronymus Bosch book that was published in recent years?
Yeah,
that one is still in my mind.
Yeah.
But this might be one to read a little bit about where he fits into the other Renaissance. Bernard Akema, Fernando Checa Cremades, and the book is published by Cernunnos in 2024, the year of publication. Thanks for that, Jess. Happy Christmas to you.
To you.
I hope you get the art book you want from Santa.
Yes.
Send off your letter now, nice and soon. Draw a nice picture with it. That might help. That is our lot for this Thursday evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. I will be back with you tomorrow night at 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1. And John Creedon will be with you after. Oh, I'm very early out tonight. Let me not cause consternation in Cork, because I will tell you what I have for you tomorrow night, if I can find it here. I have TV reviews. We'll be talking about The Sticky, which is about a maple syrup farmer who gets involved in all sorts of, well, she doesn't get involved in criminality. A group of criminals come in and start to annoy her along the way. We have Dexter. It's an origin story, kind of a prequel to the Dexter, that Original Sin is the extra title. It's a prequel to the Dexter that we may have known and loved a while back. And what is the third one that I can't remember now offhand? It's just said into my ear again, no good deed will go unpunished. Thank you for saying it into my ear. And that, now it's 8 o'clock, so I will hand over. And John Creedon will be with you after the news.